Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Actually kind of awesome, considering the state of the world.
I'm making it.
Before we get started, I'd like to thank our new sponsor, CGMP Consulting. CGMP Consulting is a Chicago-based engineering firm founded in 2001. We support clients in FDA-regulated industries with engineering solutions and regulatory strategies to meet current industry needs. Our primary clients are in pharmaceuticals and medical devices. From this experience, we have been able to develop quality systems and solutions for other clients in lower-risk industries, nutritional supplements, excipients, distributors, and cannabis. If you have a need, please contact us at cgmpconsulting.com and tell them Across the Movie Aisle sent you. Now on to the show. Up this week in controversies and controversies, is the WWE an essential business? According to the state of Florida, it definitely is. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, said that the pro wrestling organization can keep working during the coronavirus crisis. On the one hand, this is obviously kind of silly. The WWE isn't essential in any real definition of the word. It's not essential in the same way that a hospital is, or a restaurant is, or a grocery store is. No one needs the WWE to survive. Except for people who work at the WWE. On the other, the WWE isn't like a movie theater. You don't have to watch the thing in a group setting. And live events are now being taped in front of empty stands with skeleton film crews. They have adapted to the crisis just like everybody else. At the end of the day, what this really shows us is that allowing a political entity to determine what is and what isn't necessary will always be kind of arbitrary and beholden to political pressures. The WWE is a huge employer in the state. And Linda McMahon, of course, has deep ties to the Trump administration. Peter, doesn't this just show the folly of giving the state the power to stop and start businesses? Or is there a good reason the WWE can open while, say, the beach is shut down in Florida?
Well, states have had the power to stop and start businesses for public health reasons for at least a century. The police power is pretty well established by the courts. The state governments hold it. The federal government, for the most part, does not. And so that's just sort of built into our constitutional system, is that governors have that power, whether or not you think they should. In terms of the WWE, I will say, like, on the one hand, it does demonstrate the arbitrariness of it. It does demonstrate that there are judgment calls. It is kind of silly. I'm sure. I wouldn't say I'm sure. It seems completely plausible to me that there are political reasons for this, even if they are unacknowledged. On the other hand, a business that can function and provides entertainment and enjoyment to people, no matter how ridiculous, and the WWE is completely ridiculous, no matter
but
how
awesome.
Ridiculous, is the kind of thing that, like, if we don't have to shut it down, we shouldn't. We should try to allow those businesses that can operate to operate, whether they are paint stores or whether they are, guys who take a lot of steroids and pretend, or maybe kind of not pretend, to, like, beat each other up for our entertainment purposes. I don't know. I just want to point out the fanless WWE thing has produced some absolutely amazing video clips in which these guys who are playing to a crowd that doesn't exist. And so they're out there doing this thing that is designed for mass public consumption in the middle of an arena that is filled with, like, you know, rowdy Floridians. And it's just completely silent and weird. And it becomes, somebody compared it to, like, a Samuel Beckett play, right? It just becomes this existentialist, like, weird art exercise. Like, it's experimental theater now. It's actually kind of bizarre and wonderful. And I would encourage people who may not normally watch WWE, and that would include me, to find some of these clips.
Yeah, the clips on Twitter are pretty great. Alyssa, what do you think? What should the state of Florida do with the WWE?
So this is the point at which I reveal myself to be a professional wrestling fan, not in, like, a dedicated long-term way, but as someone who periodically just watches it when it's on television, has been to a couple of matches live and really enjoyed them. It's kind of awesome and hilarious, and it's a form that gave us Dwayne Johnson, the man who will eventually become president of the United States of America when all of this is over. And so I really enjoy it.
And John Cena.
And John Cena. Yes.
Right? I mean, like, the Princess Bride would not be the Princess Bride.
Professional wrestling. But this is also a situation in which I am going to do something that I will never do again and agree with Governor DeSantis. Because I think that anything that where people can find a way to do it reasonably safely, but that encourages people to stay home and ensures them that they will be entertained, actually has real value in this moment. And we have largely been protected from these sorts of decisions because of the way the entertainment industry production schedule works, right? I mean, we've been talking about Devs and Westworld among us. Both of us were shows where the current or only season was ordered in 2018, was shot and edited in 2019, and was released this year. But at some point, the entertainment industry content pipeline will run out. There will not be new shows. There will not be new movies. And that is a, you know, bored Americans are Americans who are less likely to stay in their houses. And so if you can keep like the kayfabe pipeline running, then maybe you can keep some Americans home and you can keep the people who work below the line operating on those skeleton camera crews employed. And, you know, there are huge questions facing the entertainment industry about everything from, you know, recurrence of the virus to how you even ensure production anymore. And, you know, if small-scale ridiculous experiments like this keep people entertained, keep people at home, keep a certain number of people employed, and start providing the sort of test cases that can help people figure out how to produce content again, I actually think there's real value in that.
I'm glad we're all in agreement here, more or less. But I wonder... if we can't extend this a bit further, because I mean, look, in the announcement of, you know, the federal government's hopes to reopen things, right? Theaters were included in the next phase in phase one or phase two of reopenings. Basically, once you flatten the curve and you start getting the lower numbers of cases, states should be allowed to open up theaters with certain restrictions, of course, you know, 6 feet of distance and all that. I guess my question is, you know, where do you draw the line on what is a reasonable business taking reasonable precautions, and where do you just say, okay, well, you're not allowed to do this? Because this is where my like inner libertarian like starts to get a little bit itchy, right? Is when somebody says, well, obviously it's good that the WWE should be able to do this, but if you have, let's say, a movie theater that usually has 200 seats and you're only selling tickets to 50 of them and it's like three per row, you know, every other row, why shouldn't they be allowed to do that? I'll say this, like, even right now at the moment of the crisis in where we are, like, it strikes me as vaguely unreasonable, frankly, to shut down a movie theater and to shut down, frankly, all the movie theaters without giving them at least the chance to kind of introduce the social distancing necessary to operate safely.
Well, look, and regardless of what the government does, cultural institutions are going to have to win back the public by proving that they can keep them safe, right? I mean, you know, it's kind of a joke that a lot of movie theaters are staffed by, you know, high school kids who don't do a great job of cleaning up the popcorn and are just sort of selling tickets so they can watch movies on their breaks. But these are not institutions that necessarily have a demonstrable record of like managing public health effectively, right? And that's not to say that there isn't a way forward, but movie theaters are going to have to demonstrate that they can, you know, put together plans that will make people feel safe and comfortable regardless of whether or not they're allowed to open, right? I mean, the three of us have seen so many movies together, and even if you space people out in theaters, like, what happens when someone who's in the middle of the row has to get up and go to the bathroom, right? Like, there are all of these little logistical challenges that theaters are going to have to solve to make people safe whether or not they're allowed to be open. Yeah, I mean, I think the distinction between, you know, should the government be allowed to do this? Is that sensible? And shouldn't these businesses have to win back the public trust? It's sort of arbitrary because, as with everything about reopening, you know, what the government says is going to matter only so much to whether or not people come back.
I distinctly remember seeing a screening of, I want to say, Lethal Weapon 4 in a multiplex in Destin, Florida, near where I grew up. And this place was one of the weird features about this theater was the incredible level of darkness in the seats when the movie was playing. So they didn't have the normal sort of little guide lights or, you know, those little low lights that would show you sort of how to get out of the theater. And so the place just kind of got engulfed in a cloud of darkness where, like, you could barely see your own feet, much less, like, the hand of the person next to you. And one of the things that this lent itself to was an extremely dirty theater because it was, in fact, staffed by 15, 16, 17-year-olds who really didn't care, and, like, the managers were maybe 19 years old, you know. And so I have a distinct memory of coming in and walking through these a floor where you kind of had to pull your foot up every time, right? It was like you were walking through some sort of sticky gunk, and then I stepped in something that was noticeably worse than it should have been. It looked like somebody had been sick on the floor. And so went and reported this to the workers, right? Tried to clean off my shoe, the whole thing. Went back and sat down, avoided it this time, sat far enough away that I wasn't going to step in it. And I saw the kids come out, and they had their cleaning supplies in their hands. And they gathered around it and got close and looked and pulled out a flashlight and then looked up at each other and said, "Oh no, that's not puke. It's just popcorn and Coke," and left it. And they left it. They didn't bother to clean it up at all. And so that is the level of service that I think a lot of movie theaters are operating at. And if you expect them to manage complex public health issues, I think there's going to be some complications. I think in one way you could look at this and say they have to prove to people, you know, they have sort of a market incentive to prove to people. And that's totally true, right? Like they are going to need to rebuild trust. In another way, it's just not at all clear that they really know what they're doing or that anybody does with this sort of thing. I think in some ways that mitigates towards some of the restrictions. In some ways it mitigates against them. I would also just note, if you guys remember, in the week or so before the shutdowns really started to take hold across the country, a bunch of places, including Washington, D.C., actually experimented with rules that said you could be open, but only under certain conditions. So restaurants in Washington, D.C. were supposed to have no bar seating, and everybody and all tables were 6 feet apart. This is totally unenforceable. You can't send cops to every bar and restaurant in Washington, D.C. with measuring tapes every night just to see if the tables are properly distanced. Similarly, you can't do something like that with movie theaters. And so if you're a government regulator, like, you kind of have to build into your expectations that movie theaters will at best be inconsistent about applying whatever rules you expect them to apply. And that's why I have just continued to be skeptical that movie theaters are going to be open here in the next few months. Maybe some places will experiment with it. Maybe in less dense parts of the country where there are fewer cases, they will just go ahead and open things and have some suggestions there or guidelines, but they won't be enforceable.
That are just more serious about how they operate in general will manage to figure this out, right? Like, you know, the Landmark at the Atlanta Plumbing Development in DC, where we used to go to movies a lot. You know, that's a place that's serious about its sound and projection. It's nice. It's immaculate. And it's already done assigned seating. One of the ways they can do that is just, like, create a seating matrix where there are fewer seats available and sort of space
and
you out that
them.
Way.
And yeah, rotate exactly. them, like, showing after showing. Like, some seats are available one showing, some seats are available the next, and you kind of do it, stagger it that
right.
way.
I mean, like, it's a little bit of, you know, you have to write some code to do that, but it's not that hard. And that's a theater where if they said, you know, if they sent out an email to us that was like, these are all the steps we're taking, I would trust them to actually do it because I trust them to, you know, mask the screen appropriately on a movie. I trust them to, like, have the sound calibrated in a way that's decent. And because there's a level of professionalism in the way that they approach all of the parts of the operation, like, that's a movie theater that if they had a plan, I would probably go back to.
I wish I shared your confidence. It's not that I think that Landmark is going to try and do a bad job. I think they're going to try and do a good job. They're a great theater. I would love to have some confidence that theaters like that are going to be find a way to make this work. I really wish that movie theaters could be reopened, guys. I miss it so much. I miss watching movies with y'all. Sonny, sorry, we may never watch a movie together again. But I just think that in terms of, there's still so little we know about actual transmission. There was a study that has it that's in preprint, so it hasn't been peer reviewed. That's been going around this week, showing that the vector for transmission is gatherings indoors. That outdoors is relatively safe, but that indoor gatherings where you put a bunch of people in a room, that's pretty much how this thing gets spread. That's what watching movies is, at least at a movie theater. And I think movie theaters are really going to struggle to figure out some way that they can be confident, that viewers can be confident, that regulators are going to accept. Again, I wish I was more hopeful about this, but I think it's months and months before most theaters certainly in dense parts of the country end up reopening.
All right. So is it a controversy or a non-controversy that the WWE has been allowed to stay open?
It is. I'm tearing my shirt apart here with happy rage. I think it's a good thing. I don't know whether that make it a controversy or not. It's a non-controversy.
It's a non-controversy.
All right, non-controversy. Okay, great. On to our main program. Up this week is Netflix's Lost Girls. It stars Amy Ryan as a blue-collar mom holding down two jobs while trying to raise two kids, with a third who lives out of the home. Lost Girls is a dark and somber police procedural about whose murders the police are willing to expend resources trying to solve and which communities will be protected. Liz Garbus directs Lost Girls pretty starkly. There's definitely a David Fincher-like sheen to the proceedings at times, that kind of bluish hue with little figures against big backgrounds suggesting the smallness of the people trying to solve the enormous problem that they face. It also has some weird casting quirks, and as much as I love the leads in this, Amy Ryan and Gabriel Byrne, who plays a police chief who is trying to solve the murders while also keeping the mothers quiet and also not getting fired from his job, it also has actors like Dennis from 30 Rock who shows up. And like when this happened, again, Peter doesn't understand this because he doesn't watch TV comedy shows, but when this happened to me, I was so kind of shocked by it that I was like just jolted out of the movie. It's like, Alyssa, do you remember the Jeff Nichols movie where Justin Kroll shows up as like a civil rights lawyer? Loving, that's what it was called. And I was just like, wait, why is the guy from the league here? You know, it doesn't work for the seriousness of the production. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Alyssa, what did you make of this movie?
Man, I was really frustrated by this movie, and I'm the one who recommended that we watch it because I've read the book by Robert Colker, which is a really kind of remarkable true crime book. And I say that it's remarkable in that it's a book that's really oriented towards the victims, and a set of victims who in this case were mostly working as sex workers on Craigslist and who are the kind of people who, as is clear in the course of the case, were easy for the police and a lot of other people to dismiss. And Colker really brings these women to the fore as human beings. He's curious about how they got where they were, what they meant to the people who lost them. And what's kind of bizarre about Lost Girls as a movie is the titular lost girls don't emerge as people at all, basically. It's a decision not to do flashbacks. It makes a certain amount of sense. It's a pretty, you know, tight movie. It's not very long. But it's definitely just a weird lacuna in the middle of the movie that this book that is incredibly empathetic about these, you know, young women who disappeared and who were murdered and really is aimed at restoring value to their lives. And the movie just doesn't do that at all. It makes me wonder why Netflix adapted this book at all if it wasn't interested in what made it distinct.
Peter, what did you think?
It's a well-made movie in a lot of ways. It's very raw. I think some of the performances are really pretty good, especially Gabriel Byrne and Amy Ryan. I think Alyssa's right. It actually sort of almost overlooks the murdered women and treats instead the family members as the real victims. And the movie is really intensely focused on the family members. And I suppose I can see the case for doing this in that it is an inversion of a kind of typical serial killer story, not so much in that it focuses on the victims, on the dead, on the people who were killed, but on the people who were left alive. And that's pretty unusual, especially for a movie that then all of those people, right, that sort of we have this this collection of female family members who are standing up for their loved ones who have been killed and who are trying to get justice and who ultimately, spoilers, who ultimately fail. The killer is there. The movie suggests a candidate, but the killer is not caught. And so it's really interesting. And I think, you know, there's I've never seen anything quite like this in that it is a procedural that doesn't quite resolve. It is not quite a police movie, even though the main action, the plot is driven by what the police do and don't do in a lot of ways. Though, of course, you know, the Marie Gilbert, who's played by Amy Ryan, drives the police to do a lot of what they do by demanding that they actually take their job seriously.
They take her daughter seriously, yes. Even though the movie doesn't, right?
Yep. That's right. And the movie takes the family members pretty seriously and takes their plight pretty seriously in a way that I think it's certainly honorable. It's often well done, but not always. And it's a short movie, and part of the way that they make it short is by having a lot of scenes in which Amy Ryan sort of delivers monologues that kind of just say what the scene is about, rather than actually having the scene do the work of being about the thing that it's about. And Amy Ryan is an incredibly compelling performer, so she basically pulls it off and makes somewhat ham-fisted material work pretty well. It's directed in a way that is stark enough that I think, you know, it's visually interesting enough to look at. But it's one of these movies that sort of feels well-intentioned and often well-executed, but doesn't quite come together. And also, it's raw enough and sort of and dark enough without.
It's not pleasant.
Yeah, without offering something to sort of keep me going, well, except for the performances, except for the actors themselves, that like, yeah. I'm not sure I can recommend this movie to other people. And that's what I was sort of thinking was, it's not like I want to say this is a bad movie, and it's not quite like I want to slag it. At the same time, who would I tell to watch this movie?
Yeah. It's definitely, I'll be honest, I found myself kind of drifting off and not paying attention to it while I was watching it. And partly this is the Netflix curse, right? That like, you know, Netflix is just making content to capture your attention, at least briefly, from some other object.
40% of your attention, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. But like it feels wrong for this subject matter. I mean, like the idea I kept coming back to, and I hinted at this a little in my intro, is that it feels almost like dumb Zodiac.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. It's upsetting. It has the sort of encounters with someone who might be the killer, but who you can't quite pin down.
Right.
It's got that sort of very cool color palette, but without any of the sort of like mustard that shows up in Zodiac.
Yeah. It's like not quite as stylish, and it's not quite as tightly scripted, even though Zodiac is longer. Zodiac's a solid, you know, hour, almost hour and a half longer than this, right? That's a 150 minute movie. And this is, you know, it's fine. It's very fine, and it feels, I don't know, just with the cast, again, even with the missteps in the casting, it feels like a wasted opportunity, frankly, like just bottom line.
And I will take a minute to defend the casting of Dean Winters, who plays Dennis on 30 Rock and the Vulture on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. in that he plays a character that we don't see very often, which is the cop who's just pretty contemptuous of the victim, and who basically thinks these women are, like, you know, sluts who are not worth investigating, and has, you know, a certain amount of contempt for the mothers. And I think there are a lot of really good people who work in law enforcement, but there are also people who are dumb and cruel and lazy. And, you know, pop culture likes to show us cops who are, like, dramatically corrupt or whatever, but it rarely shows us the people who are kind of just small-minded and not great at their jobs because they have contempt for victims. And yeah. I think that was actually a sort of interesting thing to see on screen. And Winters, like, I mean, part of what's interesting about seeing Dean Winters in this role is that, you know, he used to be, he's a Law and Order veteran. Like, he actually played a cop who was, like, kind of too sensitive for the job that he was doing. And so there is something kind of interesting about seeing him here in a role where he is a type who is very rarely depicted, but definitely exists, and is uncomfortable to look at in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I actually like him a lot. I like him in Oz. I like him on 30 Rock. I think he's a good actor. I just don't think he's right here. And I do think that there's a way to have that role pulled off in a way that's not jokey. And I think that's my problem with it, is that it just, like, and maybe this is a me problem and not a him problem, but, you know, because of the way he has been cast, certainly in recent years, it just doesn't quite work for me. But again, that might be unfair.
Do you guys think that part of the movie's difficulty in telling a fuller story stems from director Liz Garbus's background as a documentary filmmaker? Because it kind of struck me that the movie was constructed in many ways in the way that a documentary might be, which is to say, you know, you sort of pull from the scenes that you could actually get, right? That you actually know something like this happened, right? That, like, and that in many cases, movies that are based on real, you know, sort of on real life, they're not just sort of recreating scenes that happened. They are adding and contextual, or certainly not just recreating scenes that happened. They are not just recreating scenes that a documentarian could get. And that, right, and they're sort of, they're willing to go to places that documentarians can't go and aren't used to going. This seems like, in some ways, like Garbus almost wanted to create a kind of a documentary, but maybe didn't have even enough material here. Like, and it's just, I don't know exactly what it is, but it seems like she's not quite used to working with in a mode where, like, you can just access stuff that documentarians can't ever really access, because certainly for if you're making a feature, like a film documentary, right, you can never get video of certain incidents. You can never get images of, say, the night that a woman is being attacked, essentially never, right? And so, you know, there's all these scenes that just sort of feel like this is something that somebody sort of narrated this moment when the women gather at a diner, right? Somebody narrated this conversation that these two women probably had together. Somebody, right? There's a bunch of stuff that that depicts scenes that were captured by local news. It really sort of feels like it is a drama of a documentary that wasn't made. And I think that because of that, it just sort of, it's a little bit limited. Again, well-made in certain ways. She's obviously a talented filmmaker, but I think not totally used to working in this mode.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I would say is that there is actually a fairly obvious way forward to get beyond the book a little bit. And that's something that shows up in, you know, a coda before the title credits, which is, you know, Mary Gilbert was murdered by one of her daughters, who had a psychotic episode and killed her. It's incredibly sad. And Kolker did a follow-up piece about that. But there's a version of this movie that is more tightly about Mary and her daughters, and about the fact that Shannon Gilbert, who, again, I realize we've been talking about how the movie dismisses her and we haven't actually said her name on the show, that looks at what Shannon Gilbert struggled with and what her mom struggled to give her, why she gave her, you know, up to foster care, how she tried to build a relationship with her afterwards, and the relationships that she tried to build with her other daughters. And so a story that is less narrowly about the investigation and more broadly is the story of Mary Gilbert and her daughters would have sort of broken free of the structure of the book and allowed the movie to tell a different story that goes beyond the investigation. It would have been an even bleaker and more despairing movie, but it would have had a different structure and a different shape. And it could have put the Gilbert girls more at the center of the story in a way that I think they maybe don't deserve to be.
Okie doke. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Lost Girls?
Thumbs down to my disappointment.
I'll give it a thumbs up, actually, though a weird sort of thumbs up, which is that I think the movie's well made enough to deserve good marks and also not really recommendable.
I will go thumbs down. I'll be simpler on that one. All right, on to assigned viewing. Because of the chaotic nature of the release schedule and the fact that, well, we're just all looking for something to watch, everyone out there just wants something to watch, we're changing this segment up a bit for the foreseeable future. Instead of assigning a movie that has something to do with what we're talking about next week, we're going to assign something that we just love and want to share. I'm going to go first. And my choice this week was Tombstone, which I was inspired to rewatch after running a series of stories by Michael Biehn, who plays Johnny Ringo in the movie, about the making of Tombstone. You can read those at rebellermedia.com. They're all right up there on the front page on a row at the top. So click over there, read them, you'll love them. I'm not going to belabor that here. Instead, I would like to highlight this movie's amazing cast. Michael Biehn, of course, but also Kurt Russell, Bill Paxton, Sam Elliott, Val Kilmer, Powers Booth, Thomas Hayden Church, Stephen Lang, Jason Priestley, Billy Bob Thornton, John Corbett, Michael Rooker, and wait, who's that last one? It's Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston is in this picture for like two scenes. I am always like kind of shocked when I just watch the credits at the end of this movie, just the like murderer's row of everyone who was in this. It is
literally and figuratively.
Yeah, it's a decidedly old fashioned non-revisionist Western about white hats and black hats set against sunsets and the plains and the deserts, and everyone's on top of horses and we've all got six shooters and big hats. And I totally unironically love this movie. Even though it is, again, all of those things I said, old-fashioned and non-revisionist and, kind of a stale format, some would say. Val Kilmer gets the lion's share of praise for his Doc Holliday, and I think a lot of people think he should have won an Oscar for that role. I tend to agree with them. But everyone brings something fantastic to the table. Alyssa, did you enjoy Tombstone?
I really did. You know, some of it is just the pleasure of watching actor after actor pop up in this, right? I mean, when you're in that relatively early bar scene and you hear Billy Bob Thornton's voice before his, you know, face even totally emerges, and she's like, wait, another one? It's also just really beautiful. It's a beautifully shot movie. It's really painterly. And in a way that's sort of old fashioned, and I think that a lot of people would dismiss now, right? I mean, you have a lot of these sort of tableau like shots. You've got stuff that looks like classic Western painting. I mean, that whole sequence with, you know, Powers Booth like stumbling out of the opium den and shooting up downtown Tombstone is like so sort of rigorously formally composed. But it's also, I mean, it's also an interesting entrant in sort of movies that are ostensibly about men being manly, but are really about men just having a lot of feelings that I really
and not write. Knowing what to do with them. That's the essential thing about being manly.
Yes. But it's, I mean, it's this, you know, it's a very tender movie in a lot of ways. I mean, the sort of the total sweetness of the Wyatt Earp Doc Holliday relationship is like genuinely kind of lovely and charming. And it's, I mean, look, all of the Fast and Furious movies are this movie, basically, right? It's just, I mean, it's a whole sort of, it's a whole thing. And
in the end, it's always about family.
Yes.
Right? And like, yes, you can totally see Kurt Russell, like who ends up in the Fast and Furious movies
as Mr. Nobody
because of his history in films like this. Like you could totally see him and Sam Elliott like busting out a Corona at the end of this.
Yeah, 100%. And so it's a combination of things that I like that are sort of old fashioned, but like the just the emotionalism, the sort of painterly quality of the filmmaking. And yeah, I mean, I think there's a case to be made that this is the movie with the best cast ever, right? I mean,
I was thinking about that before the show, and the only other one I would really throw up against it, again, just like kind of thinking about it off the top of my head, was Heat, which also has Val Kilmer. And it's also from about the same time, and it's another role Val Kilmer might maybe should have won an Oscar for. But, you know, Heat with De Niro and Pacino and Kilmer, of course, but then also everybody else who was in that movie. That's a real winner for me. I don't know. Peter, what did you make of Tombstone?
I actually thought about Heat while I was watching it. And, you know, Heat came a couple of years after this, but they're from around the same time, and they're both of kind of movies about gangs, you know, sort of about rival gangs on opposite sides of law enforcement, right? About male bonding and male friendship, and how, you know, sort of how men become brothers in arms and end up both fighting each other and relating to each other. Heat certainly makes much more about the relationship between cops and criminals than this one does. You know, sort of suggests that they're essentially the same in a way that Tombstone, I think, doesn't. But there's a real kind of there's real sort of push and pull that is, or how should I say, the movie really makes an effort to create parallels between the good guys and the bad guys here, in particular, between Michael Biehn's character and Val Kilmer's character, right, who are sort of the extremely showy and effective henchmen, you know, and how, and then, you know, even at the end, right, there's a group of the cowboys of the bad guy gang who end up joining the good guy gang, basically out of saying, well, my gang violated our values, right? And like, we're going to come to you because our values are important. So it's interesting in that respect. The thing that I was thinking about, though, while watching this was that this is the canonical movie they don't make anymore. It's not just that they don't make Westerns anymore, that they don't, or when they do, they're always bleaker and more revisionist and sort of more about the idea of the Old West and of Western movies and how they presented it. It's that this is a $25 million film that was shot entirely on physical sets and against real nature. The draw was the, you know, the way it looked, but really the cast and the cast interaction and the script. And this is not like a great for the ages script, and yet it's a really nicely written script in a lot of ways. Every scene gives you at least one very good character beat. Every scene does meaningful work to advance our understanding of the internal dynamics between, you know, sort of in the factions or just to push the plot along. Right, they all kind of have these discrete openings and closings, you know, to the individual scenes. There's this great bit when we meet Doc Holliday and he's gambling, you know, and drunkenly, and first, you know, and of course he wins a big pot and gets, you know, there's the guy he wins it from gets really mad, and so we see Doc Holliday first. We see him, we see how fast he can be with his drawing his gun, but then we also see him interact with his wife at the beginning of the scene and at the end of the scene, right? And there's this little, you know, this little like joke that opens and closes the scene. Oh, I see you're not wearing a bustle, right? And then at the end, it's, that's why you're not wearing a bustle, right? Because we're gonna, you know, and there's this, just all these like little writerly bits that are written from the understanding and the assumption that every person who sees this movie will speak English, right? There's no, and that's, and like that it's a big budget, big star film about a kind of a big action film that assumes an essentially American audience that is familiar with how Americans speak and that is, and who will take pleasure in the deployment of clever dialogue that is well structured and scenes that are actually written rather than just sort of plotted.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the script because there is some controversy about the making of this movie. That the original script was It was written by Kevin Jarry, who also wrote Glory and some other stuff. He was going to direct this. This was he directed the first 4 weeks of this movie, and the studio and the backers and the producers were like, "This is you. What you are shooting is not good, and we need to make it better." So they fired him and brought in George P. Cosmatos, who. This is where there is some controversy as to who really directed Tombstone. Kurt Russell has taken a fair amount of credit in recent years, and again, talking in the pieces that Michael Biehn wrote for us and that Stephen Lang also sat down for an interview. You know, they both say, look, Cosmatos shot the picture, but he didn't really direct it in the sense of like telling actors what to do or laying out what the shot selection was going to be or like laying down what scenes were going to be done that day. That was basically all Kurt Russell, which is interesting. It's interesting. And when you talk to these guys, when you talk to Biehn and Lang, and I think some of the other cowboys, the actors who played the cowboys would agree with this. What happened with the script is they cut out 20, 30 pages. And basically, they flattened it from a kind of more, frankly, a more revisionist Western where you had, you know, the white hats and the black hats are more like gray hats, into something that is very, very much more black hat, white hat. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. And when you talk to these guys, they're all like kind of disappointed by the final product, which I find kind of hilarious because, or not hilarious, but like, just it's shocking to me because the thing that is the strength about this movie is how old-fashioned it is. Frankly, I think the reason it has become a basic cable classic is because you have those good guys and you have those bad guys, and it's like, okay, well, this is what the story is, and it's I don't know, it's interesting. Wait, I'm sorry, Alyssa, what were you gonna say?
The one thing I was gonna say about it is this is a movie that sort of brings up something that is. I think comes up repeatedly for me as a critic, which is just that it's a really strong movie. I really like the extent to which it's about men and masculinity. It's also a movie that could have been a little better if it hadn't wasted some of its actresses. And, you know, I think for a lot of folks, like, you're looking at this and you think about Powers Booth in Deadwood, but it's also a movie that features Paula Malcolmson, who is also fantastic in Deadwood, and the movie just does nothing with her, right? I mean, she's basically here to, you know, like, be really sad in a couple of scenes when, you know, when her husband gets maimed, and it's a total waste, right? I mean, one of the things we know from those revisionist Westerns is that the dynamics between men and women in the West were sort of more interesting and complicated than the sort of damsel in distress getting, you know, robbed in her carriage by a highwayman, whatever dynamic. And, you know, I think in contemporary film criticism, it is difficult to point something like that out without people saying, well, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Tombstone's a really good movie. It's, you know, like we said, it's a total murderer's row. But it's also a movie that leaves something on the table, in that it cast a pretty good crew of actresses, Malcolmson most important among them, and then just does nothing with them. And that's a little bit of a loss.
See, I would go the other way. I would actually just cut out. I would cut out, like, the whole Dana Delaney subplot. Like, that can go on the trash. It should just be about bromance. No romance, just bromance in this.
Yeah, well, and the romance is really poorly done. And also the fact that, like, Wyatt Earp just sort of, like, ditches his first common law wife and then she dies of laudanum addiction and, like, but he met someone who was better for him. It's just, like, it's ridiculous.
One of them was shot in, like, a hazy glow and the other one was always shot with, like, a kind of pasty, sickly look. So, yeah. You know, it was inevitable, right? There's no way he could have... Like, but this is, I mean, that's part of what that plot is about, is that he couldn't resist her. There's no questioning it. You know,
he just needs to like dance with her. And so, I mean, that ending is literally more sentimental than the ending of like the 1994 adaptation of Little Women. Right. I mean, it's just cheesier. And I think one of the great sort of undercounted things about these super masculine movies, they could be like cheesy and sentimental as all hell and nobody treats them like they're like soft or, you know, sentimental.
I will say
manliness, but
I will say that even most Tombstone fans are like, yeah, we could, the romance subplot is, you know, it's a bit much. All right. It's a little cheesy. Next week is Alyssa's turn to assign us some viewing, and she has chosen Buster Keaton's The General, which is streaming on Amazon Prime. That is it for today's show. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up for a membership, we don't get to keep doing this. And remember, there's 2 months free. Just look at the top of the website. There's a little box in the left-hand corner. Click it. Go through it. You'll not be disappointed. If you love the show, tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we'll die. We're kind of like sharks that way. And review us at Apple. And if you didn't love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. Thank you once again to our new sponsor, CGMP Consulting. Make sure to check them out and tell them you heard about them from us. That would be great. I will see you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sanye. Associate producer, Jessica Safa-Vamer. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.